It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
By the year 2000, people started believing in the advent of widespread email culture that the United States Postal Service was doomed. Conservatives and business types argued that it was a bloated institution. But it's not. In fact, it's a vital, robust network that is literally a failsafe in the doomsday plans of the federal government. These days, while people may not be sending many letters or postcards, the USPS is an essential service helping us vote, get our medicine, and deliver us packages. President Trump isn't a fan.
The Postal Service is a joke because they're handing out packages for Amazon and other internet companies, and every time they bring a package, they lose money on it.
But Motherboard reporter Aaron Gordon is, and he's just launched a newsletter, The Mail, which is all about the USPS. And you should all subscribe to The Mail. Enter your email address at vice.com/themail. Again, that's vice.com/themail for this amazing new newsletter on the USPS. Aaron is on the show this week to tell us more about the future of the Postal Service. Aaron, I think this is your first time on the show, isn't it?
It is.
It's taken too long.
I'm sure you've had much better guests than me.
No, not true. Not true. I've had Jason. So
oh, all right. Definitely. Yeah, I take that back then.
Okay. Well, you know, you're the person to talk about because you've done some incredible reporting over the last little while on infrastructure in general. And, you know, you had some recent articles on the controversy surrounding the USPS and our president, Mr. Donald Trump. And I want to ask you, you know, just to start things off, give me sort of a 30,000 foot look at what's going on, the controversy that's taken place over the last little while.
Sure. So, as you probably know, Trump has had a thing about the post office basically his entire presidency because he has this weird like mental model that that Jeff Bezos, who he hates because he also owns the Washington Post, uses the post office. It rips off the post office to profit his company, Amazon. And this has somehow become an object of Trump's fascination. And then more recently, obviously, the post office has been under incredible financial strain, like almost everything else due to the coronavirus pandemic, and needs money. And Trump has basically blocked the post office from getting any money from Congress because he doesn't like the post office, essentially. And then more recently, obviously, the post office has become super important for primary elections and soon the general election in November because people are increasingly relying on voting by mail during the pandemic to vote rather than going to in-person polling places. The recent controversy and news cycle is largely the product of a new postmaster general named Louis DeJoy, who assumed office on June 15th and has rapidly made a number of very sweeping changes to the way the post office functions. One of which he slashed overtime, which the post office really relied on to deliver mail and packages reliably every day, not just because they're short-staffed due to coronavirus, but also because of tens of thousands of attrition-related job cuts over the last decade or so due to kind of austerity politics, for lack of a better word. And so that slowed down the mail considerably. Some people are not getting reliable delivery anymore. Packages are waiting in distribution facilities for weeks. And another thing that has happened more recently is mail sorting machines, hundreds of them are getting removed from distribution facilities. The post office says they're doing this because of decreasing mail volumes and a desire to be more efficient. But the workers I've talked to say that doesn't really make any sense to them because they're completely destroying the machines or removing them from the facilities entirely. These machines cost, you know, upwards of $1 million at least. It's just completely unclear why you would destroy them when the future of mail volume is completely uncertain. And especially with the expected surge of ballots in the coming months, it seems like you would want to have some spare capacity lying around in case you need it. So that's like roughly what's going on with the post office right now. Things are happening very, very rapidly. Democrats in both chambers of Congress have taken a big interest in the post office, and we're going to be learning a lot more in the coming days and weeks, I'm sure.
I mean, Trump did actually say the quiet part out loud in terms of, I don't like the USPS, or I'm paraphrasing here, essentially because of its association with mail-in ballots.
Yeah, he basically said he doesn't want to give the USPS more money because if it doesn't have more money, then people can't vote by mail, was basically what he said. And that's a thing that he wants because he doesn't want people voting by mail. I feel like I need to at least mention that, like almost everything else Trump says, this is some combination of wrong, factually nebulous, and just completely unclear about what he's even talking about. Like, it's not evidence, at least to me, that there is some conspiracy to rig the post office. You can find that evidence elsewhere, by the way. Like, it's not, I'm not saying that definitely isn't the case, but just because Trump said these things doesn't mean it's actually what he's up to, in my mind. And, like, there are reasons for that that we can get into if you want, but, like, I just hesitate to, like, read too much into anything he says about the post office or really anything else in general.
No, I you know what? I see it in two different ways. One, I think it, when he says something like that, it's a complete, he's throwing a bone at all the media and the Democrats for them to attack and to pick up, because it's similar to, like, the way he said he was going to designate Antifa a foreign terrorist organization, which, you know, if you know anything about FTO designations, it's impossible. And he was just saying that. And it, of course, it became a massive issue, especially during, you know, a very fraught summer with BLM protests that he didn't tend to care much for. But then you look at something like this, the USPS, and then mail-in, and it goes along with voter manipulation, et cetera. But I think the bigger thing, and I think it's something you might agree with me on, is that the USPS also just seems to be this thing that conservatives and Republicans just really seem to dislike. They really want to go after it. It's always something that comes up as this, you know, bloated government bureaucracy that we have to pay for.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's funny. It almost has all the trademarks that you would expect of an agency that conservatives and Republicans wouldn't like. It's so, first of all, it's worth saying that the post office, like, since 1971, is not technically a government agency. It's like a quasi government bureaucracy, corporation, Frankenstein hybrid type deal. It used up until 1971, it was a cabinet level position. So, like, you had the Secretary of State, you had the Secretary of Treasury, you had all that stuff, and then you had the Postmaster General sitting right there. But after that, it got basically broken off from the government and in some important ways, and now it's basically like a quasi government corporation. And critically, it receives no tax money, no tax revenue, no government subsidies whatsoever. It is completely self-funded by, you know, the stamps it sells, the postage it sells, all that kind of stuff. And this was, you know, like, kind of like step one of traditional conservative business logic, that anything the government does that could pay for itself should pay for itself. And something subsidized by tax dollars is almost by definition bad. Like, is kind of like the rough rubric we've seen from conservative circles, especially when it comes to government services over the last few generations. And the post office is kind of like a special target from the right, because nearly all of its costs are labor costs. And that is like a dog whistle for conservatives about an inefficient operation. Like, if you're paying people to do something, that's bad. You should be paying, your money should be going elsewhere, is like basically conservative ideology in a nutshell. Like, something like 85% of the post office's annual costs are labor. And you look, a lot of conservatives look at that and say, that is an inefficient operation. And there's got to be, you know, they look at the amount of overtime that the post office spends, which is billions of dollars a year, and they say, well, that's stupid. Like, why are we spending so much on overtime? That's obviously inefficient. Well, the thing about the post office is it has a legal mandate to deliver mail to every single person in the country every single day, no matter where they live. And I don't know the last time you've like looked at a map of the US, but like, it's a pretty big place with lots of people living in very rural areas. And yes, like city mail delivery can probably be profitable, but there is just absolutely no shortcut to delivering physical objects to every single American that doesn't involve just an absolutely immense amount of labor, like just so much freaking work. And so there's like this fundamental contradiction at the heart of the modern post office, which is it's supposed to pay for itself while also doing all of this incredible amount of work that just simply isn't profitable. Like, how are you going to justify having someone pay 55 cents to send a letter to someone who lives in the middle of nowhere, pay someone to go give them that letter? Like, it just, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And so you have this like kind of fundamental contradiction at the heart of what the modern post office is. And a lot of its struggles are really coming out from that.
I mean, it's similar to the healthcare debate, right? How do you expect people to pay for this? At a certain point, it needs to just be taken care of by the state, just like everywhere else in the world. But I think also, you know, if you look at this, there is sort of this problem with the ways in which people see the post office in general, because you see people saying, you know, it's just to send letters to your friends. And that's, you know, it's a totally absurd concept, especially when you think about what the USPS has meant during this pandemic. I mean, the reason we have the post office is also to deliver essential goods and services like medicine, especially to some of the aging people that would actually require mail-in votes because they're older and shouldn't be exposed to coronavirus. So you look at this, and I think there's also a problem with the ways in which people are looking at the post office. We look at it like the internet age happened, email happened, no more post office. The crazy part about the internet is, at least as far as I know, you can't deliver a package through the internet yet. You can't teleport me, you know, the latest IKEA furniture table set I ordered, you know?
Well, it's so interesting you bring that up because, you know, around the time that Congress was debating this, I shouldn't say they even debated it. They didn't debate it at all. They just passed it. There was a law in 2006 called the Postal Enhancement and Accountability Act that basically was a poison pill for the post office. It required them to pre-fund their healthcare retirement benefits for employees. So like, it's basically the equivalent of if I told you, Ben, right now, that over the next 10 years, you have to set aside all the money you're going to spend on healthcare for the rest of your life. And how do you think that affect your finances? You'd probably not great, right? You'd probably run into some financial difficulties. Well, that's exactly what's happened with the post office. And that's where most of their debt comes from, is this like completely artificial mandate passed by Congress in 2006. And so the reason why I bring that up right now is because at the time, the post office was doing okay money-wise, and they thought, oh, this is fine. The post office can totally afford this. Well, two things happened. One is email really took off and people stopped sending as many like business first class express mail letters than they used to, which hurt the post office's finances for a few years. But then something happened that nobody predicted, which is the internet actually kind of saved the post office in some way by enabling e-commerce. And packages are, I mean, despite Trump's rhetoric, they seem to be beneficial for the post office's bottom line. They make money on packages, and for the most part. And so the internet actually enabled the post office to enter this new line of business that absolutely nobody predicted beforehand. So like the effect that technology has had on the post office, and this is not new, this is not just the internet. This goes back to the telegraph, you know, the radio, television, all of these communication technologies that changed the way the post office functions, or at least the way it relates to society a little bit, and maybe, you know, took some lines of businesses away, opened up new ones. But it still always had a fundamental purpose, a real core function in society. And it turns out the internet didn't change that.
No, it didn't. And that's the thing, is that we keep looking at this as if the internet has solved the problem of the post office. And it absolutely hasn't. And as you said, this is something that's dated back for years. I mean, do you also see this sort of being a bipartisan issue that Republicans and Democrats have both sort of done some damage to this institution?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look back, you know, I just mentioned the 2006 Postal Reform Act. It was obvious during the Obama administration, how detrimental this was to the post office finances. It was no secret, and they didn't do anything about it. Literally nothing. And so, you know, they had the chance to change that law, to change the payment schedule, to maybe reimburse the post office for some of the funds that it had set aside for no good reason, to put it on more solid financial footing. It didn't do any of that. And not only that, but in the wake of the recession, it very much went along with Postal Service plans and encouraged them to slash their workforce to save money. And that's part of the reason why the post office is so vulnerable today, because it has 77,000 fewer workers than it used to have. It also relies much more on temp workers who make up about, like, I think it's about 20% of the workforce today. These are basically like flexible hourly wage workers who are not the drivers of any financial problems at the post office, I can assure you. And it's actually a very difficult and thankless job. And the turnover rate is like something approaching 50% per year, because it doesn't pay well. The hours are terrible. You can't set your own schedule. You're basically on call whenever the manager wants you, and you have no job security or really any benefits to speak of. So I think, you know, and these things happened during the Obama administration. These things really took off during the Obama administration. You know, there were times where Democrats could have fixed things and they didn't. And I think that's kind of, you know, the story about a lot more than just the post office.
Yeah. And also, like, question, like, when are we going to get the drones out to help them again? Like, when's that supposed to happen, Amazon?
Yeah. I mean, like, it so much reminds me of some previous, you know, reporting beats I've been on, like, in transportation. You know, there's no reason to really invest in American public transportation because autonomous cars are right around the corner. You know, how stupid will this light rail seem when everyone's zooming around in their autonomous cars at the same time that it's finished? Well, that's what people were saying in like 2015. And I got to tell you, autonomous cars look no closer today than they were in 2015 to widespread use. Meanwhile, we continue to build out public transportation at an incredibly slow pace. And you still hear public transportation officials saying it today, like, oh, you know, we got to balance the infrastructure we want to build today with what we expect the technology to be in the future. And it's like, do we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those classic stories where, you know, it's an old institution, an old piece of infrastructure. And because of this sort of Silicon Valley way of thinking that we've all adopted since about, you know, the mid-2000s, suddenly it's like, well, it needs to be destroyed and taken away. Like, why do we even need it anymore?
Right. And there's just, the post office and public transportation and a lot of these other like kind of institutions that America has, especially public institutions that America has really kind of abandoned over the last several decades, they're so robust. You know, they're like, in kind of like a just traditional sense of that word, like they can handle lots of different climates, both economic and, you know, and meteorological, and just like, you know, they work in so many different situations, changing trends, changing tides, different places, different contexts. They just work, you know, if you just like fund them. And I feel like that's something we really just don't care enough about, is building robust institutions rather than new ones.
Right. And I think, you know, doomsday goes down, the U.S. Postal Service, it's going to help us.
Yeah. I mean, the USPS is literally part of the federal government's doomsday plans to like distribute medication to you know, areas affected by whatever doomsday scenario they're game planning, or like getting information to them if all other communication channels break down. I mean, the federal government, at least prior to this administration, thought of the post office as this way, as like this last resort way to get information between people. And I think the pandemic has really reinforced that role it plays, even though I think the role the post office is playing today for a lot of people may seem more mundane. You know, like maybe you just get like the packages you ordered online through the post office. And yeah, like that new, you know, coffee maker that you splurged on is very nice, and you're very thankful for the post office for delivering it. Like, it's much more important than that. Like, just for one example, the VA uses an online medication system that entirely depends on the post office to deliver medication to its, what, millions of veterans around the country. And so if that if that system breaks down or even slows down, like, you know, if you don't get your insulin in time or whatever, you know, these are your nitroglycerin for your heart problems. Like, these are super important systems that need to work regularly and well and be robust to deal with any potential problems that come up. You know, and the post office has traditionally been that. And I think it's scary to think about an administration or a country that doesn't value that.
I completely agree. Well, one last question. Is there any way that you think, I'm going to, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say the cyber, something technological, can really revolutionize and help the U.S. Postal Service to become more efficient, but also to become, maybe not efficient, to become even more useful to Americans?
Yeah, so I'm going to answer that in a question in two parts. First, I'm going to say that one of the greatest innovation, technological innovation stories of the 20th century is the post office. I mean, in the second half of the 20th century, it went from literally employing hundreds if not thousands of people at a given facility to hand sort mail. An incredible skill if you like know, I mean, I don't have to get into it now, but like the amount of mail that an individual well-trained sorter could handle back in those like hand sorting days was incredible. But it was still like obviously super inefficient by modern standards and very labor intensive. What the post office did was they underwent a decades long process to gradually introduce machines to sort the mail instead. And they actually pioneered one of the first optical character recognition machines in commerce to read the addresses that people hand write on letters. And it works remarkably well. And it did right from the get-go. It had like something a 97 or 98% accuracy rate when it first debuted, I think, in the 1970s. And it's only gotten better since. And so what we've seen is facilities that used to employ, you know, maybe like 800-900 people to manually sort mail now need like only a couple dozen to feed the mail into the machine and then kind of move it once it gets sorted and then, you know, repeat that at each machine terminal and, you know, some maintenance staff to maintain the machines and whatnot. So I want to, and you know, the distribution systems have gotten more sophisticated as they've used more powerful computers to kind of model what it should look like. So I think there's a tendency to think of the post office as very low tech. And in some ways, it absolutely is. You know, the guy still comes to your door and puts mail in the mailbox the same way that he did 100 years ago. But behind the scenes, the post office has made incredible technological improvements and innovation. And I think these are the types of innovation. And again, this kind of goes back to a lot of what I saw on the transportation beat, too. These are the types of innovation that really matter in making better systems. They're the incremental changes that really improve our lives in hidden ways gradually over time that we don't appreciate enough. We're always looking for that big, like, when are the drones going to deliver my mail type thing? But it's like, would a drone delivering your mail actually be any better than a human doing it? Like, what advantages does that actually offer? And aren't there a lot of ways in which that would actually be worse? You know, so there's this obsession with new technological things as being obvious, like totally new things being obviously better. But a lot of the better technological things are actually the things that happen behind the scenes that just like make processes a little bit better. And I think I will also note that like a lot of listeners might be tempted to say, oh, well, they replaced all those jobs with machines and then, you know, like derive maybe, you know, conclusions from that, you know, maybe you lean towards what a great thing this was for the post office to save money by not paying people to do this. Maybe you lean towards how horrible for those workers to not have jobs anymore. But the reality is during the time that the post office was undergoing these changes, their workforce actually was pretty stable and even grew a little bit. It depends exactly what time period you're looking at. There weren't any obvious changes to the overall size of the postal workforce while they were undergoing these innovations. because there were other things for people at the post office to do. So there was reassignments. There were people maybe who lost their jobs but then got them back doing something else. And a big part of that is because the post office has an incredibly high unionization rate. The unions help protect people's jobs. I mean, I'm sure if the post office wasn't as unionized, a lot of people would have lost their jobs permanently. But that didn't happen. And in fact, they ended up doing things like they needed more people to deliver mail because there were more people in the country during this period and more addresses to deliver to, more offices. And so like you just see people doing different jobs as opposed to, you know, losing them. And I think these are important observations to like these kinds of technological changes. Honestly, this is one thing I have reported on is their delivery trucks are super old. Like a lot of them are older than I am. I'm 30 and a lot of them are older than that. They haven't been they get something like 8 to 10 miles to the gallon. They don't have air conditioning. They're like these little tin boxes that, I mean, they've certainly served the American people well, but man, is it time for them to be retired? And the USPS is supposed to announce, a new mail delivery truck contract by the end of the year. I'm worried that it is going to be a regular old gas truck that will be better for the people making deliveries, but not what we should have in the year 2020 or 2021 or whatever they do. The fact is the post office is like a perfect candidate for electric vehicles. Like you could not come up with a use case that is better fit for like what the current technology is for electric vehicles. They go, they park in the same place every single day. They go on routes of between like 30 and 75 miles, which like is a very, very affordable battery size in electric vehicles today. Very reasonable. And they always go back to the same place. So charging is super predictable. And the federal government obviously has the money to build out the charging infrastructure and pay, you know, the slightly higher costs for acquiring the vehicles now, while realizing the long-term savings on maintenance and fuel that that electric vehicles will provide. So it's like, it's really disappointing to me to see all this talk about how the post office has to be like, oh, it has to be an efficient operation and have all these, you know, be business focused. And it's like, they're missing out on probably one of the biggest efficiencies they could implement both for themselves and for like the environment. And so that's been a real bummer to me. I hope something changes, but I'm not holding my breath for it.
Well, on that note, I'm glad to have talked about the US Post Office with you. This is an important conversation and we'll see what changes. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk again before the election because I think this mail-in vote situation will bring the USPS back into the news.
Yeah, I think that's right. Hopefully it's to better news and not something about how Trump is successfully rigging the election.
Yes, I agree. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ben.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right.
Hi, Ben.
Lorenzo, that was a contentious pre-talk. We should leave the soccer talk aside from these dark times.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know what soccer is.
These dark times. You think I'd be talking about the pandemic, but I'm talking about the state of FC Barcelona.
I have no comments on that.
The nightmarish laughingstock of European football. Anyways, nobody wants to hear this. Okay, let's get to the first story for the cipher. It is a classic tale of data and purchase that our very own Mr. Cox always comes up with. This time it involves the Secret Service and how it bought phone location data from apps. Let's go.
Yeah, this is a great example of a story. This is just a great Joseph Cox story. You know, it's been a classic of his last couple of years. What happened is that in 2017, the Secret Service purchased something called LocateX from a company called Babel Street for something like $2 million. And what LocateX does is that it shows the location data of mobile phones. In theory, it's anonymized location data. And it's location data created by ordinary apps. So any kind of like app that you can think of on your phone. And the story here is that by purchasing this data, which has been harvested by Babel Street, the Secret Service can basically sidestep the regular process of like getting a warrant and that way finding out where you've been and where suspects have been. So this is the concern. You know, there are so many companies like this, and most of them
that are buying location data from places. I mean, this is something that he's been reporting on since what, 2018 now?
Yeah, and that's the big takeaway here. You know, there's countless companies like this. Most of them are completely unknown to the public. You know, these are not companies like Palantir, even, you know, that are sort of like a household name in the surveillance and intelligence world. These are small companies that buy like location data from all these apps like Seamless or whatever. And then they package it, maybe sell it to another company that then resells it to the government. And this whole process has almost zero transparency. It's very unclear where the data comes from and what it ends up used for. So
yeah, it's very strange to see that. I mean, it's all these government agencies have been suspected of doing stuff like this before, but it's like the Secret Service.
Yeah, I mean, this shows that like everyone is interested in location data, and there's a market for it that makes it. And you know, $2 million for the Secret Service is probably not that much, so it's just another tool in their surveillance toolbox. Senator Ron Wyden is looking into these companies, is trying to find out, you know, what they do, how they work, what kind of data exactly do they have, and what kind of data exactly do they sell. And some of these companies are, like Babel Street in particular, has not even responded to his letters, hasn't even responded to his staff's calls. So Senator Wyden is like, what is going on here? We want to know what these companies are doing, what's the legal framework they're working on under.
Senator Ron Wyden, friend of the show.
Yep, and not a friend of companies that don't like your privacy or don't respect our privacy. So,
not a friend of those people at all. This is very true. He's done some great work over the years looking at this exact issue. But now we're going to be talking about something that is the closest to my heart. Kato, cue the music. We're talking about aliens, everyone.
Oh yeah, UFOs.
I'm talking about that Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. It's official. It's here. I love this.
Yeah, I think, you know, if X-Files was still around, this would be great for the show, I guess. But yeah.
I mean, it's great for me and my, just me. I love this a lot.
Yeah. I think we all love UFOs and motherboards.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
We're all looking forward to seeing what happens with this. So the Pentagon has officially launched the UAPTF, as you said, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. I wish they had hired like a marketing guy for this kind of thing. Like, I think there was potentially a better name for this, you know? But anyway, the task force will work across the whole Department of Defense and can also collaborate with government agencies. And their job is to study, like, you know, UFOs essentially, and stuff like UFOs that get spotted around military bases and and things like that.
Yeah, and it's important to also remember that the US has done this before, mm-hmm. and they kind of scuppered a program in the past, and this sort of just represents a rebolstering of this whole sort of study of UFOs and these aircraft that they can't really say what they are, mm-hmm. that come into contact with military aircraft.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Wasn't there a story recently in Popular Mechanics? I was out in the wilds doing a story, but I remember I saw this on Twitter and I lost my proverbial shit, but where it was like a source said that the Pentagon admitted that there was like they were in possession of otherworldly spacecraft.
Yeah,
spacecraft.
I'm not sure about that story, but yeah, there's been, I think what's interesting here is that the Pentagon came out.
It's a Popular Mechanics story. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is crazy.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here is that the Pentagon like announced this in a press release. You know, like they came out and said, "Yeah, we're doing this," and so it's definitely like the most public kind of like team that we've ever known about. Usually, these kind of efforts are discovered by FOIAs or after investigations, or maybe because like there's a whistleblower or something like that. But in this case, the Pentagon is saying, yeah, you know, we have a team, we're going to study this and see what happens and, you know, see what's going on. It's still unclear what kind of information they will publish and what they will reveal. But, you know, the fact that they have announced it publicly, the creation of the agency, it may indicate that they'll have more transparency around this.
Amazing. I want more. There's going to be more. If President Trump ends up being the president that admits that UFOs are real or that aliens are real, I don't know what I'll do with my 2020. I think at this point, I'll probably crawl into a cave and never come out.
Well, but think about Independence Day 3 with Trump as president.
That would be something. It would be an interesting experience.
That'd be interesting.
Or Biden. I mean, frankly, even Biden. Like, Biden's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
We're talking about aliens? I saw an alien down in Pennsylvania when I was growing up. I saw him at the Coke shop.
Oh, God. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So next is another Samantha Cole classic. I'm just going to read the headline because this is just, I think she does some of the most interesting journalism and like some of the most important journalism, frankly. But this is good. Internal emails show mayor trying to kill the fun at, quote, Bare Ass Beach. This is in Minnesota, apparently.
Yeah, this is a great FOIA scoop that Sam got here. She obtained a bunch of emails from the mayor of Golden Valley, this town in Minnesota, and the police there. And it shows that the mayor of Golden Valley was trying very hard to get the police to crack down on people that go to this beach called... Well, it's informally known as Bare Ass Beach because it's a nudist beach, and some people in the area have been complaining about this. And for some reason, the mayor is really kind of obsessed with going after people that show up naked to this beach. There's even like in one of the emails the mayor that sends to the police says, quote, the patrols need to be beefed up. We got to solve this problem of people being naked. And it's interesting because the chief of police seems initially reluctant or at least skeptical that this is really worth it. There's an email in which he says that he saw some footage of this beach and it looks like a slow day at another beach, you know, implying that he doesn't see why this is a big deal. But eventually, the end result of this, all this pressure from the mayor, is that the cops, 2 weeks later after these emails, flew a drone over the beach in an attempt to catch naked beachgoers.
It's kind of hilarious and a total violation of
privacy. Yeah, it's like, is this really what you need your police to focus on? Is this really like...
I gotta be honest with you, it's really funny. Like America's obsession with nudity is just hysterical. It's like you're allowed to watch Jack Bauer like kill a bunch of terrorists in like brutal execution style for like however long that show was on.
Wow, deep cut for. Here.
Was it a 40-minute show, 25-minute show, whatever. And then like the minute there's like a boob on TV, people are losing their, again, their proverbial shit.
Yeah, the other interesting angle here is that the city has actually approved or rather has repealed a ban to be topless on beaches. So women cannot be fined for being topless at this beach. So like even in the emails, the police says we're not going to fine women for this. And essentially they're focusing on getting, you know, men with their junk out. So just a huge mess at a city. And it's just silly, you know, why?
It is super silly. Just the anger over nudity is hilarious. It's pretty good.
And
gotta say,
yeah, we'll see if they send some predator drones at some point. I don't know.
Yep. Well, as you can see, Motherboard is always contributing an eclectic mix of news and information for our readers and listeners. So, Lorenzo, thank you for coming on the show. RIP FC Barcelona.
We'll be back. And thank you, Ben.
And you should all subscribe to The Mail. Enter your email address at vice.com/themail. Again, that's vice.com/themail for this amazing new newsletter on the USPS.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.